And it is time to get started. Once again, welcome and good morning or afternoon. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host, moderator today, and we are very glad you could be with us. We will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. If you need assistance, we've changed it up a little bit. Please look in the Q&A panel and select Help Desk from the drop-down options, and then our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you via the private chat. Now, today's topic is about planning for recovery and reconstruction before a catastrophic disaster happens in your community. There can be some very tough issues to face during this process, and it becomes even harder when your residents are in a hurry to get back to normal after a disaster has occurred. These are now hot topics in places like the New Jersey Shore and other areas hit by Sandy, who will have their work cut out for them indeed. For the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Today's recording and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Carolyn Harshman has over 30 years' experience in land use planning and emergency management. She has had her own consulting business, Emergency Planning Consultants, since 1984, delivering a wide variety of plans, exercises, and training. Please see today's background page for further biographical details and links to related resources that she will mention during the presentation today. And also, I want to point out an excellent article published yesterday in the Huffington Post that is related to this topic. Welcome, Carolyn. I thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today, and I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Well, it's certainly my distinct pleasure to be joining all of you today. I gave this presentation at the International Association of Emergency Managers back in October, and it really is a fascinating topic to me, and obviously to the 62 of you who have signed on for the webinar, it must be fascinating to you too. Just for the sake of introduction, a couple of additional points to build on what Amy was saying. My background, I actually have sort of a split career. My first career was in city planning, where I was responsible for developing community plans and changing zoning ordinances and learning all of the different development regulations that go into establishing the future for a city or a county, as it's true, too. And in the middle of that career, I had an opportunity to do disaster planning, and although it turned out there weren't very many similarities, I really couldn't help but bring in the city planning experience that I had, and it troubles me sometimes to see how we have almost deliberate disasters happening that were really preventable, and mostly because our development ordinances are encouraging us to live in the wrong places. And so that's sort of the background of premise and why I have this perspective. And so let me take you through some of the slides. First of all, the question of when does the rush to normalcy begin? And we're familiar with the four phases of emergency management that are on the screen here. The two phases that really cause the highest level of uncertainty and urgency, or I guess you could call it panic, first of all is the response phase, because we're really focused very much on human safety and being able to keep people safe, get them out of harm's way, instant stabilization, and other steps like that. The second phase that causes a great deal of panic is the recovery phase itself. As you can see in the pictures in this slide, in the upper left-hand corner, this man in a mobile home park, whether his house is burning right now or not, believe me, he is very anxious to be able to get back in, have that feeling of comfort and normalcy that we all strive for and very much enjoy. The picture of the troubled decision maker in the middle of the slide really, to me, exemplifies the government's sense of uncertainty about what to do, where to go, how to organize the community and be able to get back on its feet, because the organization wants to have that that feeling of comforting and that sense of normalcy as well. In looking at what I call normalcy, and I borrow this source from the Fundamentals of Emergency Management, it's a textbook on this topic, these boxes, although kind of a crude drawing, it really does represent a sort of 30,000-foot perspective of what a community looks like. You can see that the two boxes, the big boxes across the top of infrastructure and government, are intricately connected to the households that we live in. It doesn't matter what kind of house or home or structure or whatever it is we live in, but we do hang out someplace at night, and it brings us not only comfort but protection. It connects us up to the infrastructure. We support ourselves with our businesses, our work environments, and then we get other forms of support, like goods and services. We get affection, we get emotional support from our peers. On the other side of the scale, on the business side, we get goods and services. We have exchanged things using money. We sell to people. There are competitors that come in, and then there are suppliers that support all the households and the businesses. And so in a real simple kind of way, I think this is an effective look at what normalcy is. But now let me walk you through how not normal looks. Here's a different perspective of infrastructure. This picture is taken from Katrina, and obviously the bridge is not designed to do this. It was level before, and yet because of the tidal surges and winds, this is the way that the infrastructure fell apart. It's completely unuseful now. Government, another example here, the picture on the left is clearly a picture of a very common town hall in a small community. Picture on the right is a great example of what that exact same building looked like after it had been impacted by a hurricane. In terms of peers, the whole point of this picture is that, you know, these people could easily have just been walking along this town, having a conversation, hanging out at Starbucks or whatever. Instead, because of a disaster, this is what the nature of their relationship is today. This picture in terms of households, you can see this beautiful mansion of before and the contrast of what today's representation looks like. In terms of businesses, obviously, we rely on businesses not only for our own sources of employment. We also shop there. We do all sorts of things. We eat there. We rely on businesses. It's really the backbone of our economic existence. And so when you look at an example like this of the before and after, obviously that store, even if it was open, it would be really difficult for people to be able to come and go, and therefore it's not going to provide much use to any of us. So what are really the challenges of recovery planning, and why am I really recommending that you do pre-disaster recovery planning? Just in looking at those pictures, you can see that the emotional rush to normalcy is because people really do want to get back to their jobs, their families. They want to be able to use the things that they own. They want to be able to enjoy the pictures of their families or whatever normalcy is for them. And so the challenge, because of all of that emotional and passionate pushing from businesses and residential owners alike, many times the decision makers are put in a very uncomfortable position, and this is meant to be a mayor standing on the front steps of City Hall. Within sometimes seconds of a major disaster, the mayor stands out in front of everyone and says, "You have my word, you'll be back in your homes in no time." So that partly comes from the fact that the mayor, too, has been impacted and wants to have that sense of normalcy again. But better yet, as a leader of an organization, he or she recognizes that that's what everyone wants, and that's where the rush comes from, because instead of doing it right, we go into this ready, fire, aim kind of mode where we get the order screwed up and the outcome is equally bad off. A few misconceptions about recovery, because I think this is important to talk about, too. The first misconception is that the entire recovery effort can be improvised after the emergency response is complete. In other words, well, we're just going to wing it. We'll see what we have left, and we'll go from there. The truth that's identified here is that an effective recovery really does require an extensive amount of data and collection. And if you have a better idea ahead of time, as you would if you did a pre-disaster recovery plan, you would have a very good idea of property values, location of goods and services, up-to-date demographic records, and lots of things that you would need to be able to get funding to support your recovery effort. And so that's part of why you don't want to just wait until it happens. And the second misconception is that the objective of disaster recovery should be to restore the community back to the condition that existed before the disaster. And, you know, I think it's really time for us to change that definition, because if we really do restore our community back to what it was, it'll be just as vulnerable to disaster again as it was before this disaster. So we really do have to put it back different. Like if you think for a minute about the Humpty Dumpty rhyme, and, you know, we wanted to put him back together again, but maybe would have been better off with a slightly different design. I say that with a smile. Recovery misconception number three, it's a real popular one. Lightning never strikes twice. But let's find out what Hurricane Camille had to say about that, and then there are also lots of examples from Hurricane Katrina. With Hurricane Camille, you may have seen some of these pictures before, but for those of you who haven't, let me tell this bit of a story. Hurricane Camille came along, and in 1969, the apartment building was built at Passe Christian in Mississippi. When the hurricane, there was a big hurricane party when they knew that there was a hurricane coming, and the majority of the people that were in the building that stayed for the hurricane party were washed away. Their bodies were found later, and most of the building was completely gone. In fact, really, the only thing that remains, as you can see here in the picture, are the trees. Isn't it interesting that we build things and it doesn't survive at all, and yet nature built something and it survives even a hurricane? That same exact property had been rebuilt as a small shopping center in advance of Katrina, and if you take a look at where the trees were before and where the trees are now, nature survived once again for the most part. But the shopping center that was built on exactly the same footprint is still exactly 100% wiped out. And so you have to really ask yourself, well, then what's the point of recovery planning? And first of all, I'd like to offer this definition of recovery, and it's certainly not my own definition, but one that I have seen commonly in many different textbooks and articles, that disaster recovery is the combination of restoring, reshaping, and rebuilding our physical, social, economic, and natural environments. Now, I want to go back for just a minute to my earlier days as a city planner, and if I look at this list of physical, social, economic, and natural environments, that's exactly what a general plan is. So if you don't think about it being taken apart through the disaster process, the physical, social, economic, and natural environment are exactly the components that make up a general or comprehensive plan that provides a guideline on how things will be built, where they will be built, the materials that will be used. There are even use requirements in terms of in the zoning ordinance. You can have use restrictions, like you can't have noise after a certain time of day, or the building has to be painted a certain color, or all sorts of things like that. And so you have a lot of controls that are laid out in your general plan. And so if the general plan or comprehensive plan is deliberately putting development in harm's way, then eventually you'll get what you're asking for. Another thing to think about is that this is a recovery model timeline, and it's not a model like a hopeful thing. But it's a typical representation of what the recovery steps look like. You can see those on the left. The tasks include assessing the damage scenario. In other words, what kind of impact have we had? The emergency sheltering process. And notice that the horizontal axis is indicated in terms of days, weeks, months, and years. And so don't be looking at this and thinking it only takes a few days or weeks. This is over a very extended period of time. And we know from recent experiences that These guidelines really haven't changed a whole lot in the last 20 or 30 years. The amount of time that you have closures of businesses and infrastructure is still considerable. In fact, if anything, the timelines probably increased because we're serving so many more people than we were many years ago. The damage assessment process itself lasts even longer now than it did before because there's a lot more to look at. We have, when we have impacts from a major disaster, we have a lot more buildings in harm's way, and therefore a lot more people are affected. If there are geologic issues, as there would be in an earthquake-related emergency, you can see that that can't even start until some of the debris has been cleared and you can go in through the evaluative process. Demolition takes many, many months, again, depending on the size of the community and the densities that are involved. We've seen examples in lots of recent emergencies where you can have individual homes that are turned to rubble, flattened by some kind of an emergency, as contrasted with the towers and the 9/11 situation where everything came down to the ground and so much of it was pulverized and disappeared. And so demolition is all over the scale, very difficult to try and predict what kind of debris you'll be left with and what you'll have to clean up. Establishment of temporary business sites. If you can't go back and fix up your own business, there have been many, many cases where communities, like after Loma Prieta, the city of Santa Cruz, set up temporary like tents and such to be able to allow businesses to keep keeping the commerce of the community going forward. Temporary housing of all sorts of, you could probably remember the Katrina cottages. The permit processing is that rebuilding process begins to take hold. And notice that in the chart that we're looking at, it's starting within the first couple of weeks after an emergency. And so that's exactly that point right there is really the essence of the problem. Our rush to normalcy before we really rethink, hey, do I want to put it back in exactly the same place with exactly the same use, exactly the same building materials, without mitigating against or moving in some regard or rebuilding or restructuring or retrofitting in some regard to be able to compensate the fact that this disaster could very well happen again. And then, of course, the reconstruction planning and then the actual construction process itself. And so there's a lot there. And if you really look at that table and you think about, well, how would this play out in my own community, I think you can begin to understand what the recovery process is, how painful it is, and how important it is that we do it right. So I've already talked about some of these points in terms of why pre-disaster recovery planning is important, but I also definitely want to give credit to Dennis Mileti, who's the author of Disasters by Design. It's an absolutely fabulous book. It really emphasizes a lot of the points that I'm agreeing with here today, and I want to pay a tribute to Dennis by honoring his words and putting them here before you. You can read these points on your own. And let me go on to the next slide because there's some other points I'd like to emphasize even more. The process of pre-disaster recovery planning avoids tempting opportunity to make the same mistake twice. It also achieves greater public safety and community involvement because you're doing this planning ahead of time just like a good mitigation plan. You're getting community involvement, and especially since this is so much at the core of development planning, you have lots of people interested in where things are built and how they are built. And believe me, the city and county processes that go on right now in your own communities are robust. They're very diverse. They involve a cross-section of owners and renters and businesses and residential and industrial and all the other pieces that make up the development puzzle. Most importantly, as Dennis points out, it can help communities think on their feet because you've already come up with guidelines. You're going to basically be looking at an ordinance. It's going to be a guideline that says, okay, let's think now about providing housing. What are the things that we want to think about regarding housing during this pre-disaster recovery process? And in writing, it's going to give you some pointers that are going to say, let's think about, have there been significant increases in density since this building was built? Do we maybe need to change the density? Should it go up? Should it go down? Should the siding be different for the building because of what we know now about the disasters that have affected us? That's just a small example. What I want to do now for the next few minutes is to talk about a pre-disaster recovery plan that I assisted the city of Chula Vista with. Chula Vista happens to be my hometown. I live in San Diego. My business is in San Diego. I actually grew up in Chula Vista, went to Chula Vista High School. And the city of Chula Vista hired me to assist them with developing a pre-disaster recovery plan. Just that you understand the planning scenario here, it's about a 50-square-mile area, population about 200,000. The hazards, it's in Southern California, of course it's vulnerable to earthquakes, flooding to a certain extent, not lots of riverine flooding because we have a lot of dams that protect us from that, but certainly vulnerable to wildfire. If you were to increase this map out and look farther to the east, you'd see that it's hugging right up against the hills, and of course, like lots of communities, we suffer from wildland-urban interface. The racial makeup is about 50-50 white and Hispanic. The major policies, and think of these as chapters of the pre-disaster recovery plan, the major chapters that we established within that plan, the first one is rehabilitation. And the questions that were raised in that section really had to do with, do we fix something or do we tear it down and build something new to a different standard, to a completely different use? In other words, don't just automatically put something back exactly the same. And also don't just fix it without really thinking about whether or not you should be making significant changes in what that use is. The second of the policies is the public sector services and really taking the opportunity to rethink whether or not you need, as you can see in the pictures, whether or not you need maybe more or less in terms of public community services like open areas and things like that. Generally, we would all vote for more uses like that. And given the opportunity with a clean slate of a jurisdiction that's had a significant impact, you do have an opportunity to do things very differently. The picture of the school is there deliberately. If you've had a massive shift, and I know we've seen this in San Diego over the last few years, there aren't as many K-12 kids here now, and so we have several elementary schools that sit vacant, and yet there's a big reservation to sell off that property. And so if your community is going through a huge cycle like that or is changing significantly because maybe you have a huge increase in industry, again, this is a chance to really relook at your community. And so public sector is another one of those important areas. The next of the policies is economic recovery. These are all pictures taken from communities that have been radically impacted by disaster in the past, and they have come back, as we all know. Many, many small businesses never come back after disaster. These are some of the successful stories. And so you need to look at, again, I come back to the development standards and say, if you look at the way that an area is zoned, is that the way that you want it now? I mean, are there some maybe some business uses that are considered now to be unacceptable in the community? And now that you have an opportunity to be able to redesignate, you should use those powers if that's something that the community overall has been wanting to do. In terms of the land use and reuse, these pictures are from Greensburg, Kansas, before and after the tornado in 2007. It's a pretty radical example of the fact you can see the street patterns, you know, the before and after. The streets were disheveled, but you can still see the patterns. You can still see exactly where they are, and you can see the layout. If you have an area that has been impacted this severely, I would encourage you to realize that you don't necessarily have to keep the same exact street patterns. You have the opportunity to be able to, through either the redevelopment process or the reconstruction process, to be able to do what's called lot consolidations. You can include easements from roadways and create completely new roadways. again, if you really look at this as a clean slate, all of a sudden you see that pre-disaster recovery planning could be a really terrific opportunity. And then if something does happen in the future, you would have insights and vision into how you want to be in the future. The next of the categories is psychological rehabilitation, and recognizing that this kind of a large event will have a massive impact on your own staff, whether you're a city or a county or other jurisdiction. It also affects your citizens. It affects the business owners, and it's going to have an enormous impact on the community. And what kinds of social services can you put in place to be able to assist people with that aspect of recovery? The next category is the issue of vital records. The picture on the left shows the reason why. Obviously, you need to be able to protect your vital records, and so this is another one of the components of the plan. And then where are they actually being kept? And most of us that do emergency management work recognize that it's critical that you have this. Whether you're doing a pre-disaster recovery plan or not, this is a really vital component to your continuity planning. Interjurisdictional relationships, I love this picture. To me, it just really exemplifies the challenges of interjurisdictional planning. And if you think about where you are, you're one of the entities that's listed on the left if you're a public sector entity. And you do, in fact, interact with all of these different jurisdictions in one way or another, and they will be impacted by you doing your pre-disaster recovery planning, just as they will be involved in your actual response. There is a policy group that was put together, and you would certainly want to do that. It's a standalone recovery task force. It could be an existing group of some sort, like a planning commission. For those of you who don't have city planning exposure, or maybe you haven't even talked with your city or county planners in your emergency management efforts, I certainly do encourage you to meet them, because I think after this presentation, you'll really see rather clearly that the city planners really have a whole lot to say in where buildings go, how they're used, how they're constructed, and how the infrastructure ties everything together. So certainly involving them in your task force would be a good idea. In terms of the lessons learned of this entire planning process that we went through, even for the people who do planning on a regular basis, or somebody who does zoning code enforcement, someone that focuses in historic preservation and is protecting one particular aspect of the community, or other kinds of specialized perspectives like the capital improvement plans that help us to build infrastructure and other kinds of public improvements over a very long period of time, because it takes a long time to fund those things. We realized how important each one of those items are in terms of making a statement and helping to implement a pre-disaster recovery plan for the future. That these plans are all written in a sort of ideal world, and there are very few, in fact, at least within the city of Chula Vista, none of the documents talked at all in any regard about what the reality would be if they were ever impacted by a major disaster and how they would go back and relook at any of these documents. So that was a real eye-opener for the entire group, and I have to say I was pretty impressed by that as well. The last couple of slides, I would just encourage you to realize that you have a wealth of knowledge, especially in the building department, the people who do the development planning. There are so many, whether it's a map or different perspectives or blueprints of buildings, so many different resources out there that could really be very, very valuable to you in doing your own pre-disaster planning. And I wanted to leave you with a recommendation. I sort of stumbled on this TED presentation by these two sisters who had been impacted by a tornado in their own hometown, a small town in Massachusetts where you really wouldn't expect to see a tornado. But if you take a look at TED, just type in O'Neill Sisters, as you can see on the slide here, and take a look. I mean, they had nothing to do with disaster management. But they were impacted, and through good, strong social media skills, they had a really vital role in helping to move the community towards recovery for those first few hours and days. And I think you'll be really impacted by the fact that they're telling a story from a very different perspective than the traditional emergency managers. The last couple of slides, and I know that Amy has already posted some of the references that I wanted to recommend, that closes my formal presentations, and I anxiously await your questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn. We do appreciate your remarks, and I think you really communicated how we really do need to be thinking about this ahead of time. Okay, we will take any questions and comments. Let me get there to the instructions. Again, in the Q&A panel, in a moment I'm going to be closing the chat panel, and that's to make it easier for you to find and view the Q&A panel. But in the Q&A panel, please do select host from the drop-down menu and then type in the area underneath. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, so you can enter your comment or question at any time. I did have one comment earlier entered by John Pyron, and he says, thank you for your commentary on recovery misconception number 2. I've been saying the same thing for a while in the Missouri Disaster Case Management Program, and I'm glad that the sentiment is being shared more widely. I've got one for you, Carolyn, while we're waiting for folks to think about what they might want to ask about. One of the things that occurs to me, how important is it to involve your elected officials in this pre-disaster recovery planning?
Very important, but here's the challenge of it, is that if you involve one, you're pretty well forced to involve everyone. As an example, if you're dealing with the city council, it's doubtful that you will get one liaison that will come in and serve as a representative of the council. At least that's my experience. And the reason is because when you start talking about development issues and property rights and things like that, there one representative will be very nervous about making a precedent or establishing a precedent or saying anything that sounds like any kind of a policy. And so my experience has been that the recovery team that is putting together the pre-disaster plan instead would present to the city council, get the entire council's perspective, maybe even do a special workshop so that they can talk about it. But to have one member on the overall task force doesn't seem to work very well.
Is this the type of planning? I know that at least in city government, there's usually some kind of planning commission or so
mm-hmm.
on. Did you do this Chula Vista recovery planning under that framework? Was the commission involved or the equivalent thereof?
No, it was all staff members. So you had engineering, public works, planning department, capital improvement program. You had the staff members who were involved in the actual development process. And then after the plan was prepared, it was presented in a workshop to the Planning Commission. And we actually went through several scenarios of how the community could be impacted with a particular planning scenario, like a 7.5 earthquake, you know, in the middle of downtown Chula Vista as an example, and gave them a very good sense about what it would look like and what kind of opportunity there could be there to be able to make improvements. And with visuals, with graphics, with a good interactive workshop, light bulbs definitely came on.
Very good. Now we do have a number of questions and comments that we'll get to. Jim Hutchinson says, as changes to land use impact private property owners, how have you seen them incentivized to become engaged?
Well, in terms of doing pre-disaster recovery planning, I mean, typically that's something that happens within the jurisdiction, and it's a policy document, and so it goes through a public review process. And, you know, pre-disaster recovery planning isn't on most people's radar, and so even though individual property owners probably would really like to have a say, I mean, it could affect how I can use my property. That's pretty fundamental stuff. So even though they would be very interested if they realized what it was, you typically really don't see a lot of participation from the public on things like recovery and mitigation planning.
I have a question from George Adams, who asks, how do you change the elected official's mindset that it will never happen here?
You know, with schematics and, of course, with things like Photoshop and GIS opportunities, estimates, but altering photos, I'm telling you, is probably the absolute most powerful thing I've ever done. If you do Photoshop and you show what your community, they have to be able to look at it and say, yep, that's my downtown, and turn it to rubble. And I wasn't even using sophisticated damage software. It's something you can do, you know, with some fairly crude skills and have very convincing results.
A picture is worth a thousand words, right?
It sure is, and there's nothing like seeing your downtown in a big pile to get the point.
Good point. Okay, Rick Skinner says, you say we need a new definition of recovery, perhaps even a new term. What do you suggest that incorporates the need to, quote, make better and improve resilience?
Well, and thank you, Rick, for that comment, because you know, resilience is really the whole key. And, you know, recover is a term that you hear like a, you know, you have surgery and you go to recovery and then you recover after that. And it always is sort of implied that it's only going to take a few days or a few weeks, because we tend to use the word in the medical sector a lot. And so it always seems very defined, and it's not pleasant, but it's going to be over soon. And so I really do think a new word, and resilience is exactly what we want to talk about. We don't want to resist disasters, because that's a big struggle and we're going to lose that battle. But to be resilient to disaster means that we have built and using effective materials, we have built recognizing and respecting the power of nature, and we can coexist with nature. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But I think that if we were going to change the word, I would vote for resilient.
Very good. Kit Hope asks, how do you deal with those who see post-disaster rezoning as illegal, quote, taking of their property, that is, changing intended use and therefore value?
That's a tricky one, and when I was still a city planner, I did some redevelopment planning, and so I understand the concept of taking, and I'll explain it briefly to the rest of the audience. When, let's say that a highway is going to go in, and part of your backyard is in what needs to be a future freeway easement, and so the government needs to be able to take it from you, and you will be compensated for the land, but that's where the word taking comes from. There are techniques that have been used in other parts of the country through the redevelopment process and also after just rebuilding in general, not always using redevelopment monies, where even whole communities have been relocated away from the shoreline, away from a very active and hyperactive even river. And so there are opportunities where you can do land swaps. You can swap your land. It can be dedicated for maybe open space or some kind of public easement or some kind of other acceptable use. And in exchange for that, you would have access to maybe government-owned property or lands that have been consolidated so that you can go through a whole new subdivision process in a different part of the town. So, I think the key to it is that, yes, I can understand the whole concept of taking. At the same time, though, if you want to be able to live in your community and you don't want to see your house washed away again, you're going to have to either relocate on your own, and then you would be losing everything, or the possibility of having to rebuild or retrofit. Both of those could be very, very expensive. So I think we have to look outside the box and recognize that we'll be better off as a whole community if we take this approach.
And we could do a whole another program on that, taking.
Yeah, that's the truth. It's a sensitive subject.
Okay, Mark Stevenson says, current hazard mitigation grant funding through FEMA strenuously avoids both response enhancement and recovery. Much skill will be needed to include this in hazard mitigation planning. Ideas, thoughts, and, you know, perhaps we could also expand this a little bit to what's the relationship between your hazard mitigation plan and your recovery and reconstruction plan.
Well, and I do both, and there is definitely a segue, and I think that if the mitigation plans were being more aggressive and talking about actively seeking out changing things like the general plan and the community plan and the zoning ordinance, the next time that they're updated to actually seek out opportunities to stop putting the wrong buildings in harm's way and to be actually changing development patterns. I mean, if you look across the country from a city planning perspective, you would be horrified to see how many elementary schools and nursing homes there are right by the river. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that's not really an appropriate place. And so this is a big problem for many, many parts of the country. We have laws in place in California that you can't put a hospital on an earthquake fault, but it took a law to do that because lots of times the information's not available to the public. It's maybe being covered up by the people that are doing the development, or maybe maps just aren't available in the jurisdiction. So we tend to learn the hard way. And so getting back to the original question of the relationship between the mitigation plan, if you are effectively mitigating, which is to minimize or eliminate threats associated with hazards, if you are doing that through a successful mitigation planning process, you will be making yourself more resilient, but it will not cover in the kind of detail that you need some of the specific policies and components of the actual pre-disaster recovery plan.
Okay, from Ava Jean Moore, she says, Carolyn, thank you for the presentation. What are the factors in pre-disaster recovery planning that are the biggest obstacles from your perspective? How do we overcome them?
You know, and it just came up in a question a few minutes ago, the issue of taking. Anytime the general plan is updated, a community plan is updated, the zoning ordinance is updated, there are people that are watchdogs. I mean, there are community support organizations and developers and builders and people that benefit from the construction process that are watching for either down zonings, and that's some people would certainly argue that that's a form of taking. If I used to be able to have a high-density building and now I can only have a two-story house, then you've been down-zoned. And so there are issues like that, and those are very, very politically sensitive. You don't go so far as to give specific details because, after all, you don't know where the disaster is going to impact you. But you do want to have those ducks in a row. You want to be open to the possibility of making those kinds of changes to your development code should the opportunity ever arise. But clearly, the taking issue is by far the number one point of resistance.
Kelly Klima, she says, the Center for Clean Air Policy has an upcoming webinar on bridging the gap between hazard mitigation and climate adaptation.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'll have to look that one up, Kelly. Thank you very much for getting it on our list. And she says, would you please comment on the overlaps you see between these groups, that is the hazard mitigation and climate adaptation?
Well, there's no doubt that we have a whole new category of hazard, and we thought we'd be looking at it in the next couple hundred years, and instead it's in our lifetimes. The factor of climate change in many regards is not that surprising from the perspective of many of the scientists. The reality is that the Earth is changing, nature is changing. We have forest fires in the area near where I live, and the population becomes very complacent after a forest fire is done because they have this attitude that it's not going to happen for another 1,000 years. And yet, of course, only a very small amount of the burnable material has actually been destroyed, and so you could have another one the very next year. So I think the fact that we have such a many people don't understand that much about nature, and we don't really understand that much about how we need to be able to live together and be able to cohabitate successfully. And so I think that there's a very important educational process there, and that can certainly be embedded into the mitigation planning process successfully.
A perfect example of that is the 100-year flood, right, Karen?
Absolutely. Yeah, we talk about changing names. We need to change that one.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Jim Hutchinson, he asks, have you done recovery planning with localities using the new DHS concept of recovery support functions?
No, I have not. Not since those have been published, and I would certainly like to set some time aside to give some thought to how I would do that, but I have not yet.
We are coming to the end of our queue on questions and comments. We do have a little bit more time, so if you have any additional comments and questions, go ahead and please put them in at this point. I'm going to go ahead and, Carolyn, and I'm going to change back to your slide deck, and I'm going to go to the end and put up your contact information. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's get that here in case you think of questions later on. That's a good place to get in touch. And we skipped the slides, but Carolyn did provide a number of references to various planning documents, including the new long-term disaster recovery framework document, and then some really excellent publications from the American Planning Association. Or is that the right name of that?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and those, if you're in the emergency management arena, you may not be aware of, but those look like really excellent resources. So links to all those documents are on
mm-hmm.
our background page. We also do have the link to that TED Talk, so you don't have to go Google it.
Mm-hmm.
You can link get directly to it, and it is quite interesting. It really illustrates if you don't have your plans ready and ready to go, someone else will do it for you. Okay. And Jim Hudgens says, I have seen the O'Neill sisters on TED, and it is an interesting talk.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. You know, people will be resourceful, and they will come together. It's our nature. And with social media now, a group of people can be very, very powerful, as we know.
Yep. I did have one from Jim, another one, and I kind of skipped it, Jim, because I wasn't sure exactly what you meant by disaster overlay. He asked, did the Chula Vista city planners establish a, quote, disaster overlay when doing community planning, or did you get that far?
We did not get that far, but it is written specifically into the pre-disaster plan that they would want to establish an overlay area, so that you'd be very an overlay for those of you. If you think about a map and then you have a boundary, an area, let's say that it's prone to landslide, you're going to identify where that area is, and that area would be considered an overlay for landslide. And so the area that could be either could be or has been impacted by a disaster, you would identify that as your study area. So no, we didn't do that, but that would be one of the first steps in the when they actually activate their plan.
I see. Good deal. Now I know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm not getting any further questions. One thing Rick Skinner came back with, he said he was the one that was asking about a new term for recover, and he suggests how about resilify.
I like that.
Pretty cute. Yeah, good one, Rick. Okay, well, I think we are going to go ahead and wrap it up today. If there are no further comments or questions, and on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much, Carolyn, for being with us.
My pleasure.
And sharing this valuable information, and even some places that are currently struggling. It may be too late for them to do pre-disaster planning, but if there's not a more vivid illustration of why communities should take these steps and get real with it, we've had this amply demonstrated on the East Coast. Okay, I am for our participants today. Thank you very much for the good questions, the good comments. Before you run off, we would like you to take a moment to give us a little feedback on the session. And our next program is, this is our last program for 2012. We've had a wonderful year. Look forward to a good year next year as well. Our next program will be scheduled for January 9th, and our topic will be the National Weather Service's Warning Decision Training Branch and the resources they have available for emergency managers, including training on the new dual polarization radars that are in the process of being installed around the country. And I think you'll find that one very interesting. So we would like to take this opportunity to wish you and your family a safe and joyous holiday season and a happy new year. Have a great day, everyone. We are adjourned. See you next year.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.